Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Now, agenda item 5 from B through C, D, E, and F. As I foreshadowed just before the break, what I would like Mr. Linus to do now is to lead on these items and to put starting summary positions responding to the deadline two positions from the other parties in front of us, so that essentially if we're starting to map terrain on which some form of additional agreement might be emerging, then we're doing that, and if we're not, we're not. But at least by the end of today, everybody knows very clearly where they stand. So, Mr. Linus.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Thank you very much, sir. What I'm going to ask Mr. Rogers to do is to take the first couple of agenda items and deal in turn with C room for pilotage operations and explain our position, summarise what was said at deadline two, and explain our position on pilotage transfer operations first of all, and then move down and deal with the inshore route. And C room there under agenda item 5B. I think those are the two sort of bulkiest elements of this part of the agenda. And then we can pick up after that is done some of the other items in the agenda, whether that's before other parties have had a chance to comment on A and B or after.
I think probably the most time efficient mechanism now would actually be just to get the whole story onto the table. And I guess recognising that F is a matter that is probably going to be of greatest interest to ports and maybe of less concern in terms of safety-related issues.
Yes, well, in that context, Scott Linus for the applicant, I'll ask Ed Rogers to explain the position, first for pilotage C-room and secondly for inshore C-room, please.
Ed Rogers for the applicant. So as we discussed before, I think there are a number of different calculations that we have for the different types of activity ongoing on the inshore route, whether it's the through route or the pilot boarding. But as Mr. Lyons was saying, the sea room requirement for pilot boarding. When we look at the sea room requirement for pilot boarding, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the ESL and PLA state the requirement is 2 nautical miles plus 1 nautical mile buffer. As we've heard from Richard Jackson, that relates to a number of a judgment based on experience and a number of different factors that are built into that. It's difficult for us to look at that in the whole when the build-up of the individual aspects that make 2 nautical miles plus 1 nautical mile the golden number isn't really available in the information we've got. So looking at the deadline one responses, we looked at the London Pilot Council's calculations on sea room necessary for pilot boarding, in which they do give a range depending on the vessel types and sizes that are being serviced. In the data that we have collected through the vessel traffic survey, we identify that the largest individual vessel that dipped down to take a pilot at North East Spit was a vessel of 299 metres length overall and 40 metres beam. The taking of a pilot coming from the north, it's necessary to come between the North East Spit, Raycon Mark and the red line boundary of the wind farm, pass down to a point in or about the pilot boarding station to take that pilot on board and transfer the pilot, and then depending on the specific size of that vessel may transit north again to in between the East Margate and the Raycon Buoy, or if the draft of the vessel is too deep, it may go to the east of the Raycon Mark. So in calculating the necessary width at the northeast bit Raycon and between the Raycon mark and the red line boundary. We looked at that in terms of the calculation that provided by the London Pilot Council. Sammy, if you're able, can you revert to the deadline two response at appendix two? And if you go to paragraph 22, that would be useful. Yeah, so it should be appendix two, deadline two submission. Applicant's response to written representations on the theme of ports and shipping routes. Sorry. So the basis of the calculation within the figure is an extrapolation of the London Pilot Council's calculation, which we see the calculation taken, I wouldn't say directly from NGM 543 Annex, but certainly referred to some of the details contained in there within, I think, paragraph 10. Here we see that the calculation is undertaken for a 400-metre length vessel. The requirement was to have two vessel lengths in between each individual vessel, a margin on either side of a vessel length, and take into account the actual breadth or the beam of the vessel as well. From this, a calculation of 1.83 nautical miles was a necessary serum calculation presented by London Pilot Council. I think actually in reference to the route to the north of the wind farm, but I don't suppose that really makes much difference which route it is. It's just a calculation here. On top of that, we apply a 0.5 mile nautical mile buffer, which gives us an overall 2.3 nautical mile width. If we apply the same calculation for the largest vessel that we saw in our data set transiting down to the northeast spit between the Raycon mark and the red line boundary, then that was the 299-metre vessel with a 40-metre beam. And from that, we end up with a calculation that shows the necessary width as being 1.88 nautical miles. The distance between the Raycon mark and the red line boundary is 1.88 nautical miles, which just happens to be, I guess, whichever you look at it.
Could I just clarify, this is for turning vessels or linear movement?
This is, the calculation here is for width required for sea room. In terms of whether the vessel's turning or not, then that's not directly taken into account in this calculation. Vessels going down into the northeast bit at the point that they're at the northeast bit Raycon and the red line boundary are not necessarily turning at that point.
But we did hear evidence from that presentation on the big screen earlier on that the point here is the swing around the northeast Raycon.
We did hear that. I mean, we have no calculations been presented that identifies the necessary sea room for that particular swing.
But nevertheless, if we are talking about one of the key input elements here being the dip down, vessels coming in essentially from the north, dropping down to the diamond, picking up a pilot, and then returning to a northerly route, then by definition those are going to be vessel maneuvers that require a substantial turning element. They're going to have to pass through verging 180 degrees in order to complete that maneuver. Am I broadly correct?
I think it
and so the necessary sea room to preserve the dip down needs to entail for, you know, the largest reasonably feasible vessel the ability to make that 180 degree plus or minus maneuver. And if this doesn't do that, it might not have addressed the kind of primary design requirement that is emerging from interested parties.
I rather think this sort of challenge should be left to this, what is looking to be like a workshop that needs to take place. And it's lock people in a room until they can work out what the parameters actually are.
Yeah, Scott Lyons for the applicant. I think that's why we're at least mentioning it here with a view to progressing matters in that way.
Yeah, no, I'm grateful for it being surfaced. It's, you know, it's very useful that it's here, but we clearly are in a place where we need conversations to happen around a table, as Mr. Bradley very correctly points out, that enable the key input assumptions in terms of what that C room parameter might be to be agreed. Because if the input assumptions aren't agreed, then it's absolutely guaranteed you're never going to agree the outputs. Okay.
I think, sorry, Ed Rogers for the applicant. I think it's worth just looking at some of the vessel track plots that we put in deadline one that show the operation or the manoeuvring of vessels dipping down.
Let's have a look.
Because I think that's representative of the vessels that we've got. So if we could look at Appendix 25, Annex G to Deadline 1 submission, please, Sammy. And if we could look at... I think we need to look at the vessel length plot for dipping traffic, which is on about page 6 or so. So this particular plot extracts the tracks of vessels that we have via vessel length and shows their current transit down towards the vicinity of the pilot boarding station, where the 190-degree turn is taken and they transit back up to the north. If we look at these plots there by vessel length, so starting with vessels less than 50 metres at the top that won't take, or very unlikely to take a pilot, and even those vessels between 50 to 90 metres, although some of those are showing that they're dipping down into the pilot boarding area anyway. The largest category of vessel type that we have here is the vessel type of greater than 240 metres. We can actually see, if we look in the table within the legend, how many of those actually occur within a 31-day period. And roughly, I think there's... I can't see from here, but I think it's maybe 4 vessels of that type. Mm. Of those vessels, all those vessels actually... I think I can just make out, actually transit to the east of the northeast bit Raycon Mark. Either when the direction of travel is not presented in this particular plot, so you're not quite sure whether they're coming out to drop a pilot off or coming in to pick up a pilot. And perhaps people here are probably better placed to identify which direction they're going from their shape. But in terms of the movement of these vessels as they actually pass between the northeast bit and the red line boundary, yes, there will be an element of sweat path as they turn. Some of them are actually on a straight course as they come through that location. Mm. The swinging of the vessels and the pilot boarding is taking place further to the south. And I think that's a separate discussion from the discussion around the serum of a route or as a linear transits of vessels. I understand that the applicant is... presenting, or we've looked at this calculation analysis to present a starting point. We've talked about the ability of a workshop to try and flesh out a few more details. I understand that's, you know, the applicant is keen to press through on that. We've got a basis for a starting point. There are only so many variables within that calculation. Mm-hmm. And if you agree on those individual variables, then the final width necessary should come out of that. There's a separate calculation for the lateral width or necessary for boarding a pilot. We've got some of those details provided by the London Pilot Council that we then plotted in terms of a different type of plot that we can look at in a minute. And then there's the sort of additional element of adverse weather or safety buffer or prudent mariner room that we've got there that... we have an agreement of around about 0.5 nautical miles for vessels transiting through. in terms of vessel taking a pilot, that might be suitable, or maybe more than that. And I think that's perhaps the discussions that we need to have going forward. Is it worth just touching, we talked about the transit of vessels between the north coming in or going out of the northeast bit. The yep. next thing I think we need to talk about is the actual, the boarding of the pilot.
Yes.
Just give me a second, I'll find my notes.
Appendix 25, Annex L, figure 4.
So the runs presented here are the runs from the pilotage study, the pilotage simulations bridge transfer study. These aren't necessarily the transits of actual vessels, so this is simulated transits. I think perhaps we need to look at our submission in I think deadline 2. Sammy, can we look at Appendix 4 to Deadline 2 submission on pilotage? And if we look at Figure 5 on page 14. Based on the calculations from London Pilot Council, we have two circles presented here, not necessarily presented in the location where pilot transfers would actually have taken place for those vessel sizes, because if we look a bit further, we've got those plots as well. But just to give an indication of the widths that come out of the calculations, the internal circle there is the Grande vessel of 236 metres, and I think that shows, based on the London Pilot Council calculations, a 1.4 nautical mile circle required for pilot boarding. If we take the 299-metre vessel, then that goes to 1.57 nautical miles. If we now go and look at the next figure, which is figure 6, then we have the plot of the largest, or the vessel that we identified as the largest inshore vessel at 299 metres, coming through the inshore route at the top left. We believe they took a pilot, as Richard, I think, mentioned, to the northeast of Elbow Buoy, where we see a kink in the vessel track. So we put our circle of necessary room to board based on the LPC calculations there. If we look at the largest vessel that dipped down from the north, that was the Agios Demetrius, which was a 299-metre vessel. That's on the top right-hand side. The circle presented there is the LPC calculations about the actual pilot transfer location. The simulation results for purely the Grande class vessel is giving in the bottom left, so they're simulated results. And on the right-hand side at the bottom, we see the actual track of a Grande vessel on 13th of February 2017. And there we have the theoretical LPC calculation for pilot transfer circles on there. Within the calculations that we've got some basis to take forward the necessary room to that it took to transit or to transfer a pilot on those particular days. We're of the view that this might be a reasonable way forward to identify necessary. The sea room necessary for all pilot transfers that could happen in that particular location. And I think that's probably the approach we would look to take forward in a workshop.
Okay. And can I just ask a couple of questions about those particular figures? If we look at the bottom right, the Grande class 236 meter vessel on the 13th of the 2nd, either approaching or completing its manoeuvre, given that we don't know which direction it was going in, it seems to pass over the outermost tip of the northeast spit itself. So looking at the bathymetry there, it's actually passing into quite a shallow area of water. What was the draft of that vessel? Do we know?
I don't know. I think the draft on the top of my head. There are probably people here who would be better placed to identify the draft of Grande vessels.
I guess my question would be, does that represent a prudent track for a Grande vessel? Does anybody else want to make an observation on that?
Yeah, Andy Sine, London Pilots Council. That track would only be made at...
I think your microphone's maybe...
Yeah.
That's better.
Yeah, Andy Sine, London Pilots Council. That track would only be made probably just before or just after high water.
Right.
At Margate. So you've got... the draft of a Grande vessel is roughly about 8.6 metres in draft. So that's basically chart datum across the bank. So you'd be looking for at least 2 to 3 hours on the tide to safely cross that. The concern I have is on previous slides, and of course on the bottom left-hand side, is that the circles that you've put in there encroach upon the anchorage, and that's something that just doesn't happen. And we're looking at an available sea room on the Diamond from boarding and on the Diamond at 1.23 nautical miles between the Diamond and the half-mile exclusion zone. And I think the only exclusion zone that's been shown on a previous slide was less than a half a mile, just looking at it by scale.
Look, without preempting a clearly critically important technical discussion that needs to take place in a workshop format, as Mr. Bradley has indicated, I guess what I did want to foreshadow is that there will need to be complete clarity about the full range of input parameters, including the sea room necessary for the manoeuvring of relevant classes of vessel. And if we are saying at all states of tide, then at all states of tide, and equivalently taking into account the easternmost extent of utilisation of the anchorage, recognising, and if it's an assumption that the anchorage isn't going to move, then that also needs to be stated and clear. So that we don't get into, in inverted commas, by accident, using essentially vertical dimensions in the water column that we haven't got, because the state of the tide means that they can only be utilised in maybe 1 or 2 hours in any tidal cycle, or equivalently that we don't end up using lateral space that we haven't got, because usually there's somebody with an anchor down sitting in it. We don't want calculations that end up being amenable to that sort of relatively simple challenge. We want calculations that are conservative and robust, demonstrating the utilisation by vessels up to an agreed maximum, be that the 299 metre or the Grande class, in normally available sea room at all states of tide, unless there is a clear proposition from the applicant and indeed other experts around the table that they're prepared to accept less than all states of tide for a reason. Captain Barker.
Only to add that tide isn't the only constraint that can throw things wrong. So on a couple of those slides, there was another vessel coming from the south or whatever, so I think you would have to add into the mix the occasional fishing vessel that gets in the way. Mr. Syme would, I'm sure, tell us that there will be occasions when the planned manoeuvre is compromised by another vessel. So
And we are conscious of the fishing vessel track plots that we have seen that show essentially a reasonable number of fishing vessel tracks at 90 degrees to the general movement of vessels that are seeking to pass either through the inshore channel or make the dip. Yes.
Yeah, just one very last quick point to follow on from Captain Barker. Andy Syme, London Pilots Council, is that we can have up to three, four vessels boarding and landing pilots at the same time. And between the pilots, we discuss how we're going to pass each other safely. And then not only do we have fishing vessels to contend with, but we have, and I'm just watching a couple of them here on a live EIS feed, coming in from the northeast, and you've, with the best will in the world, you've made the most perfect passing manoeuvre, and then they just drive right through the state, through the middle of you, on the road into the Margate Roads anchorage. And it's that sort of risk, it's that sort of curveball, which really has to make you think and adjust your manoeuvre and increase the sea room. So we're looking at a grande 1.4 nautical miles to conduct the manoeuvre. We've got 1.23 available to us to the exclusion zone, and that is just not going to happen in that available sea room. And it just shows you that you compress that sea room down and then look at the ships that are moving in and out of the anchorage, and it's a very, very dangerous situation.
And then, of course, there are a whole range of other factors that we haven't necessarily taken into account, such as wind loading on the larger vessels, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, we're not going to preempt the workshop that deals with that, but I did think it was just briefly ventilating some of the thought processes around those things so that, again, when the conversations take place, they address these sorts of calculations with reference to hopefully a reasonable range of working assumptions as inputs.
Scott Lannister, applicant. Yes, sir, one must always remember, so we've been working off specific empirical survey data, and this is what we've been presenting here, but obviously any discussions that will take place will take into account factors that you have mentioned. I think the next item on the agenda, once we've raised pilotage, is that sea room and the inshore route. Sir, if I can ask Dr. Rogers to deal with that next, please.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
If I may, can I just clarify, Ed Rogers for the applicant, clarify a point about tide and vessels? If we look at the vessels that transit to dip and take a pilot, the majority of them transit between East Margate and Northeast Spit, Raycon Mark. Mm. And it's only very large vessels in drafts over 10 metres that seem to, in the data that we have, elect to transit to the north of the Northeast Spit, Raycon Mark. A lot of the vessels in the category from 7.5 metres to 10 metres are utilising the tide to transit over the northeast spit. So any calculation must therefore take into account the disposition of traffic as it transits today, and must take into account the fact that these vessels are transiting with the tide underneath them to make their destination.
Okay, well, that's a proposition that needs to be taken to that workshop and worked through. And again, if we're looking at how this emerges in a statement of common ground with reserved uncommon ground, if it is common ground that, for example, there are certain states of the tide when the majority of vessel movements take place and therefore it is reasonable for them to be accommodated, then that's the sort of thing that needs to be just a simple bullet point sentence made clear. Whereas if it isn't, then that needs to be reserved into uncommon ground.
Ed Rogers to the applicant, thank you. We briefly touched upon before the inshore route and the narrowest point of the inshore route occurs between the elbow mark and the red line boundary. If we undertake a similar calculation as we've undertaken for the northeast spit and the red line boundary for the largest vessel that we have in our data set that transited the inshore route, then according to the LPC provider calculations, within a 0.5 nautical mile buffer on there, then we end up with a width of around about 1.9 nautical miles. The distance between the elbow and the red line boundary is around about 2 nautical miles. It comes out as a very similar calculation to the northeast spit red line boundary calculation. I understand and agree that that's for vessels transiting through. It's for four vessels simultaneously transiting through that location at a single point in time. In terms of the data we have, that's a very unusual occurrence for vessels to be transiting the narrowest point all at the same time, and practice would normally dictate they would tend to follow each other rather than overtake at that point. But we have a basis of a calculation that gives us some serum distances for the inshore route as well.
Okay.
Scott Linus for the applicant. In that context, sir, I can run very briefly through the rest of the agenda. I was mindful of the time. Agenda item 5C, that relates to the pilot station. I don't think you need to add anything more to what's been said already. Agenda item 5D, pilotage more generally. The only point I would add there is that we're aware that the PLA and ESL provided figures off and restricted station parameters in the written representations between Sunk and Northeast Spit, which it appears that Northeast Spit remains on station more of the time. And then the PLA and the ESL seem to apply the same ratio of on-off station between the Sunk and Northeast Spit as representative to the Tongue. Now, we're not sure about exactly how those figures work, and what we are going to do is try and conduct a comparative assessment of wind exceedance to determine relative differences in off-station and restricted entries between the Northeast Spit and the Tongue pilot boarding station. We're not sure that the information being provided allows that calculation to be done, but we just inform the examination that that's work that we would hope to carry out and submit to the examination process and potentially discuss with PLA and ESL going forward. Under agenda item 5A, I think as matters stand, we think that there is evidence to show that sufficient sea room exists for passage in the inshore route for the largest vessel currently using that route under normal circumstances, so we don't agree that there would be a material increase in master's decisions to avoid the inner channel, and that's related to F. We don't therefore agree with the adoption of that additional 14.4 nautical mile or 1 hour steaming cost, as it's put. You'll be aware that in the NRA there were rerouting calculations carried out. And although we don't accept that rerouting would occur, our distance was 11 nautical miles, not 14. And the main reason for the difference, as we understand it, is that the rerouted vessels would be unlikely to dip into the Northeast pilot boarding station if they didn't want to transit the inshore route in the first place. I think that's the difference between our 11 nautical mile figure and the 14 nautical mile figure that's been presented.
For an inbound vessel, is that a realistic assumption in that if an inbound vessel did not take the inshore route, but it was then passing into the estuary and would be picking up a pilot, from where would it pick up a pilot if it didn't take the inshore route? And if the answer to that is Northeast Spit Diamond, then it will make the dip. Is that a reasonable assumption? That was my sense of where the 14.4 came from.
Yeah, Andy Stein, London Pilots Council. When a vessel passes the arrival arc, I mean, this happens quite frequently in bad weather. You would probably board down at the southeast or the northeast Goodwin, which is further again down to the southeast and then transit round. But that's even a longer transit period. You wouldn't go round, then dip back down in, and then around again. The basis of the transit or the pilot boarding further to the southeast is that it's unsafe for the pilot boat to actually. It's usually when we have strong northerly, northeasterly winds and weather, you wouldn't expect the pilot boat to be able to make a safe passage up to the Diamond, and therefore you would just run straight out to the northeast Goodwin, or up to the just mainly probably southeast of the Elbow Buoy, and then you would transit round. Thank you.
Richard Jackson, Estuary Services. I think probably going back to that point of something that would have taken the inshore route going round the top. If that was a vessel that, you know, obviously, as we talked about, the draft and the size, but if that was a standard vessel for us from an ESL perspective, if the weather was okay, we would still expect the ship to come to the boarding position. We wouldn't just transit north and go and meet it early, because we've still got to factor in all the other... You get into that whole argument about operational costs, and then you're back to trying to fit it in with our schedule. So, of course, the inner Diamond is our baseline assumption, as it were, so for all our organising. So just because he's gone round the wind farm doesn't mean he won't be expected to come to the dip down as well. So, we would still assume, if there was obviously room to do it, that he would come down to the Diamond and go all the way around.
Okay.
And you do see that now. You do see vessels already that could potentially take that inside route, make that decision to go round, but it, more frequently, a lot of smaller stuff will come up through the inside.
Okay. So I think there's a little more clarity now as to where the 14.4 emerged from. And again, can I make a heartfelt plea that that also gets taken to the technical workshop, so that it can be, to the extent that the applicant still has reservations about those can be properly and fully explored in a way that just isn't possible in the few minutes that we've been touching on it here, but observing that there may be a little more of a basis to it than had possibly been thought.
Yeah, Scotland, if the applicant, I mean, I don't think we are prepared at this stage to accept that, but rather than spend time at the examination, we can explore that in the meetings.
And we are in no means concluded that we accept it either, but I thought it was worth testing it in the public forum in case, essentially, we misunderstood it as well, and I don't think we do.
Scott Lanner, for the applicant. I think that's everything we'd want to say on the agenda item. Thank you very much.
Okay. Sir. Now, I'm going to just... Can I just have a brief show of hands who wants to speak in response to any of that? If your position is... A technical workshop has been offered, and if in good faith that is going to proceed within the next week, we will take our detail to that place. I'm very happy to accept that and move on. If, however, there are matters that you believe you want to submit to us because you want us to take them into account, irrespective of what happens at that workshop, then by all means put positions. So who wants to speak in response on those items? Yes, we've got Estuary Services Limited, / Port of London, London Pilots Council, Port of Tilbury, and London Gateway Ports Limited. Okay, I think we'll start down with London Pilots this time.
Andy Syme, London Pilots Council. I think one of the things we've ignored up to now is the draft of the vessels, and I think we've got to concentrate on the prudent mariner given the draft of his vessel and the delays that are likely if we start looking at accepting passage across the northeast bit, allowing for 2 hours or plus or minus on the tide. I think it can't be ignored. It has to be taken into consideration. The sea room that we've got between the elbow buoy and the exclusion zone, you were talking about 1.9 nautical miles. I've measured it several times and I only get 1.5 between the exclusion zone and the elbow buoy. It makes it very, very tight for turning anything other than sort of a class two vessel. We have to make allowances for other turning circles of vessels, three or four at a time. And if we're going to have a workshop, then we must take different snapshots, I think, along with ESL, at different boarding times and different types of vessel. A typical daily scenario, let's work through a day or something like that. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, ESL, or are we going to PLA first?
It's Alex Dillastone for the PLA and ESL. I think given the time of day it is, I think it's probably better to leave the majority of the matters for a technical workshop with the applicant, but I think Mr. Jackson just wants to say one thing about survey, so I'll pass over to him for that.
Thank you.
The one thing that I would ask, possibly if we are going to come together on this, one thing it would, if possible, be able to see is the actual tracks of the survey vessel when it did the site survey. I think it's quite important to sort of actually see where the survey vessel was during its survey. And I think that certainly from what we're hearing from members of the crew, no one's brought any evidence forward yet, but she certainly wasn't fully operational. Well, the whole operation wasn't conducted within the boundary, as was stated. We think that you have to factor in that you've got another vessel giving you navigation lights, and I think that would have had an effect on the behaviour, but it would just be helpful, possibly, to see where she was in relation to when she was studying, because quite often, as we've had with that presentation on the MSC Antigua, it said she was one of three vessels served there. The same with that Grande. She was not the only vessel being served. And with the Grande that was presented earlier with that turning circle, there was 35 knots and east-northeasterly wind that day, which means that would have had an effect on the length of duration of the transfer, you know, but also the other traffic. Those turning circles are all based on what everybody else is doing. But everything at the moment, most things have a basis of it's one vessel, it's optimum ocean conditions, everything's okay, it's all going all right. But it doesn't really give you the full picture of why that traffic is behaving the way it is. And I think that the survey vessel, I think, would have been an influence over certain things, you know, when it was doing its observations. So I would just be interested to see if we could possibly get her tracks for the duration of the surveys, if possible. Thank you.
Okay. Noted and observed. Is that...
That is all from us. Thank you, sir. Alex Goldstone.
Thank you very much. Now, finally, Mr. Owen.
Thank you, sir. Just very briefly, I think that's a very helpful suggestion to leave these issues to the workshop. I mean, certainly we've got issues with some of what was said on agenda item 5. For example, what was mentioned about the figure 1 schematic from deadline 2 and the four vessels you saw there. But I think it's a better use of time to deal with those in the workshop. So Mr. Crockett's content to defer until that stage. Yeah. Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to put anything in response to the material presented on behalf of the applicant? No. In which case, then, ladies and gentlemen, that is agenda item 5 resolved. Now, agenda item 6, we essentially had included this on the proposition that by this point in this hearing, we might have known which side of that Y-fork we were on. And so we might have been able to anticipate and essentially prepare for the direction of travel towards April. I do not think we are there yet, and I actually think that to discuss any of this in detail prior to A, a workshop, and B, deadline 3 submissions would frankly be a pretty major waste of time. If somebody disagrees with me, I'm very happy to hear a request to put matters on the subject matter of the subject matters involved in agenda item 6. But I am very much minded to say this workshop ought to happen, and we will respond in the light of what emerges from it. Is everybody in broad agreement? Similarly then, 7 was a kind of consequential opportunity for the examining authority itself responding to the matters that we had heard from you to put back matters that we thought needed to be dealt with. I think we've done that on the hoof as we've gone through. I think everybody should be reasonably clear what we're asking to be done, with, again, the strong focus on this technical workshop. I've already foreshadowed that the aviation matter was opportunistic on the basis that we might have an oral submission from the proponent for Manston. We do not. We will deal with that in writing. The procedural decisions and review of issues and actions, I trust you will bear with us for a reserved production of a written document, because, frankly, we want to go away, wrap towels around our heads, and make sure that all of the actions that we have formed still make sense in the light of the conversations that we've had today. So we will put them together, and we will do our best to issue them at the latest by Friday. Are there any other observations in relation to particular points where an individual interested party or the applicant might feel that they are at the receiving end of an action that they don't quite understand, or are you happy that we will produce a final written list that deals with all the matters that have been put out orally? Everybody is silent. On that basis, then, the next steps, well, critically and importantly, the earliest next step is the technical workshop. And the best engagement that all interested parties who have concerns about the matters that have been the subject matter of both issue-specific hearing 2 and this hearing, I mean, we're conscious that this is a potentially substantial impost on the time and resources of certain interested parties, but nevertheless, in the interests of ensuring that what may turn out to be a process that delivers points of agreement, we would strongly encourage everybody who can to commit their best resources to that process. And then we are looking forward in the timetable to deadline 3. Now, we have the issue of the relationship between the timing of this workshop and deadline 3. I mean, Mr. Linus, do you want to make a starting bid for what you think you can achieve and what might necessarily be done? Because as I indicated when we spoke about this before, my starting proposition was that to bring all of this together in concrete terms at deadline 4 feels a long way away. But deadline 3 might feel as though a sort of concluded process, documented as such, is rather too tight.
Yes. Scott Linus for the applicant. Certainly, as far as meetings and a workshop are concerned, we've already had discussions with interested parties about bilateral meetings so the experts can get together as soon as possible. As for a workshop, a multi-party workshop, we just need to, again, see how diaries might fit together and how soon that could be achieved, if it was possible. Looking beyond that, certainly by deadline 3, as I've said, it would be possible to provide an update, giving an indication as to where on the Y fork we thought we were after those discussions had taken place.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be difficult, and I don't think I would have instructions to say that by deadline 3 any sort of firm position on behalf of the applicant could be expressed. As I say, if any movement were to be made as a result of those discussions. then there may be sort of internal procedures. There would be internal procedures that have to be followed, and it may be closer to deadline or at deadline four before a clear position could be expressed as far as any possible amendments to the proposals are made. Now, we understand that there would need to be adequate time within the examination for parties to respond to any proposals that were put forward at that stage. But we're hoping that if that position were expressed, if it had to be at deadline four, that there would be enough time within the timetable to allow for comment to be made and for that to be discussed at the next issue-specific hearing.
Our principal concern is, depending which side of the Y fork we end up on, and we're looking at issue-specific hearing 8 as being the target point for the return of these issues, which at the moment is reserved for only part, optimistically, of the 16th of April. I think we all know that that's not going to happen. It's not enough time. So we have definitely got to, if we're on the contended side of the Y fork, and possibly even on the non-contended side of the Y fork, to be honest, because there's just still a lot of detail that we, I guess, had originally thought would be settled here and today that isn't and won't be, that we will need considerably more time than that. So therefore, we need to be able to serve notice of hearing dates, or rather the applicant needs to serve notice when we have instructed the applicant of available dates. That decision needs then to be taken before deadline four. What I think we're going to need then from the applicant is, by deadline three, I think we need what I can only refer to as a clear Y fork submission. And everybody else to provide at deadline three, as I had already indicated, a clear expression of view, irrespective of what the applicant says, because you won't know at that point. You'll just have to document either side of the case. You'll have to say, if it's a fully contended hearing and we're calling experts, this is the amount of time we want. This is what we think we're likely to wish to put in front of the examining authority. If it, however, is not, this is our view. If everybody gives us that, essentially in principle, request to be heard at deadline three, and the applicant gives us a Y fork submission at deadline three, we can then make the procedural decisions that we need to make around the availability of time, and notice can be served, recognising that even then, if things change beneficially, so that less time is required to be consumed, we don't have to use every single hearing day.
Scott Lanners for the applicant. Certainly, I think by deadline three, sir, we could say which side of the Y fork we're on. The concern I have is that discussions progress and if there is going to be an amended proposal put, it's going to be, I can't see how we'd be in a position for the detail of that proposal to be put at deadline three.
No.
But we could indicate which side of the Y fork we think we're going to be.
I think you're going to have to, because if you don't, we just won't have notified and reserved enough hearing time in April. But deadline four then becomes the absolute final trumpet for formal changes, because we would then need, when they were submitted, to give immediate consideration to a procedural decision about their scope and potentially the issue of materiality in terms of a change and the question of who else might need to receive notice of those.
Yes.
Now, that, I'm foreshadowing, is a procedural decision that we might need to take in slightly less gentle manner than the one that we took around the deadline one changes, where we waited until the next round of hearings and we sat with everybody in the room and we said, what do you think?
Yes.
I don't think we're going to have that luxury.
Scotland, if the applicant, that's understood, sir. I mean, perhaps if that position is reached by deadline four, we would, as part of that submission, indicate to you what our understanding was of a sort of route map, achievable route map to go forward, so that any procedural decision that had to be made could be made in the light of our position as expressed on that issue. So as at deadline four, we would indicate how we felt the subsequent timetable could operate in the light of the proposal that was being made at that time.
Now, the other thing that I'm possibly wondering about the wisdom of is that further to a YFORC submission at deadline three, if we were in a position where we were amending upwards the time required in the timetable for hearings and serving notice, we would also, given that we're amending the timetable anyway, have the possible option of including an additional deadline between deadline four and issue-specific hearing eight, which, as I see it, might serve the useful purpose of enabling parties to cross-respond to each other's deadline four submissions and very usefully clarify preliminary positions moving into the hearings in April. And it also might provide a useful point at which, if essentially what amount to old-fashioned expert witness reports are being brought forward, that they are exchanged. Now, my feeling there is if that were to happen essentially, well, it would have to happen in the week prior to the 16th of April.
Scott Lanners for the applicant. Sir, yes, we'd been thinking ahead to that eventuality and we had anticipated that course of action being taken, so that any issue-specific hearing that took place on the 16th of April or progress beyond that date, the parties are in a position to have material in front of them that could be examined in advance of the hearing.
So, for the applicant then, we've got a view that we've got essentially a common ground process, a deadline three WIFE, and a technical workshop, a deadline three YFORC submission amongst all of the other submissions that are required, which then places the examining authority in the position where it can make procedural decisions and vary the timetable if that's required. The possible in deadline four being essentially a worked-up joint position, if that is achievable, or alternatively, primary positions preparatory to hearing on a contended basis, and then a deadline 4A in the week prior to April hearings. For the exchange of formal statements and also for cross responses to each other's positions at deadline four. Okay, if the applicant is content with that, what I'm now going to do is go around the room and just check if that makes sense to everybody else, and if it does, then we know what we're doing. Okay, can I go to London Pilots Council?
Andy Sand, London Pilots, yeah, no comments on that, fine.
Thank you very much. Port of London and Estuary Services Limited.
Alex Tillerstone for Port of London Authority and Estuary Services Limited. I think that sounds like a very sensible approach. I think we need that additional time and the additional deadline.
Thank you very much. UK Chamber of Shipping.
Thank you, sir. Ben Boyle for UK Chamber of Shipping. Very happy with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Tony Evans, HM Coast Guard. Yeah, very happy with that process.
Thank you. MCA.
Rakesh Pandit, MCA. Likewise, sir, we'll echo what our colleagues have said so far. We're very happy with the approach you have suggested. We will try and commit our best time and resources as we can. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Trinity House.
Yes, Roger Harker, Trinity House. The same from us. Thank you very much. Recognise good process.
Thank you very much. And then finally to the ports.
So thank you. I think that is very sensible. It does, of course, assume that we can have the technical workshop next week.
It does indeed.
Which we will have to do our very best to facilitate and for those attending, attend. The other thing I would say, sir, is that it'd be helpful if you were able, you may not be, to give any indication as to quite how the hearings might be changed in April, because as you said, irrespective of which side of the fork we end up being on, the provision for hearings, further hearings on this issue appears inadequate. So I don't know whether you've had any thoughts as to how you might change the programme in that respect. It would just be helpful, I'm sure, for everyone to hear that at this stage if you feel able to.
Indeed. We are only at the most kind of initial and very pre-formative thoughts on possible changes to the timetable, because part of what we believe we would need in order to make a rational change to the timetable are essentially what amount to essentially time bids from yourselves. But nevertheless, I think that we are looking at a world where the April issue-specific hearing 8, which is currently set down for essentially a working day but with an open floor hearing 2 in the evening, currently set down for the 16th of April, my feeling is that the business of that hearing is likely to require at least 2 days, if not a little longer. Possibly 2 days with a middle evening might accommodate it if folk are willing to provide themselves for an evening session. I will then... So that then raises the need to potentially move compulsory acquisition hearing number 2 and issue specific hearing 9 downstream. So if we just look at diaries. Yes, I mean, we do have a reserved date for an accompanied site inspection on the 24th of April that at the moment we're not using. 18th of April, on the 18th of April that we're not currently using, my feeling would be that if we could slot the compulsory acquisition hearing 2 and the issue specific hearing 9 down into that day, that would be a tight allocation, but it might even be prudent to extend into the Friday and actually put issue-specific hearing 9 on the Friday, the compulsory acquisition hearing on the Thursday afternoon, and that gives us a reserve morning for additional time. Oh, yeah. Of course it is. Yes, so that's not possible, is it? Well, in that case, we're going to have to deal with this in the days we have available to us. So this is looking very much like 16th and 17th of April with an evening session on the 16th for issue-specific hearing number 8. That we then slip compulsory acquisition hearing number 2 and issue-specific hearing number 9 down a day into the Thursday. That is tight. It will require everybody to be as sharp as they possibly can be, and essentially to speak only to those matters that are either in a contentious setting in clear remaining dispute, or in a non-contentious setting that require particular provisions or arrangements that have not yet already been made and that require to be ventilated before the examining authorities. You know, we will be working extremely hard on those timescales.
Scott Lyons for the applicant. Sorry, I hesitate to raise it, but I know that Monday the 15th of April, the previous day, is identified as a company site inspector. Reserved it if required. Now, I know
it is required we have been formally requested. Well, this rests in the hands of the ports. If we're changing the timetable, could the ports accommodate us on an earlier day?
Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury and London Gateway. I don't see why not, in principle, sir.
Okay.
And Scotland for applicant, sorry. So it may not be the full Monday if there's any issue with travel arrangements, even if it were to alleviate some pressure on the later days, if it was an afternoon.
It could be an afternoon and evening session, for example. Indeed. Well, look, that's a useful suggestion. What I'm going to say is that unless the port can commit to a particular day now, and I suspect you might need to do some work on that, can I ask the port to take that away and respond to us by deadline 3 with a replacement full day for accompanied site inspections to the two port facilities? Ideally, I would suggest in the week prior. Can't do it. Okay? Let's look at diaries. Does because we're using the Thursday for hearings.
I think the alternative moving forward, if the Thursday has already been booked for the ASI at the ports, would it be achieving the same thing to not, we don't need that one, start at ISH 8 on the Monday?
Sorry, am I driving everybody insane? When did... Just let me remind myself, when did we formalise the port's ASI? Because we served notice saying that we were intending to carry out that ASI. Just bear with me for one moment while I review our letter. Bear with me. Yes, no, we didn't formalise that date, did we? We said that we would conduct an ASI to port facilities in Thurrock to be held in April 2019, subject to formal notice to be provided on the 12th of March. But I do think the office had had conversations with the port about the Monday. Ah, that's where. Okay, so just consulting diaries again, the office had clearly had conversation about the Thursday, but we can't proceed with that accompanied site inspection on Thursday, I think, looking at the arrangements we've already made. So I think we still need to replace that accompanied site inspection.
So, Robbie Owen, Do you have any site inspection already planned for the 15th of April?
For the 15th?
Because that's already reserved as well as the 18th. So you've got two days reserved, haven't you, at the moment? Mm.
Yeah. Indeed.
And we obviously the 18th has been knocked out because you're shifting the hearings back a day.
No, we could do that. We could do that.
So should we confirm at deadline 3 whether the ports could make Monday the 15th?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, let's see what the best resolve is that we can achieve. Can I ask the ports to review the potential availability of Monday the 15th of April for an accompanied site inspection? We will then seek to redistribute hearings into the rest of the week. And we will make the best cut of it that we can. But I think we will need a view from the port about the achievability of the Monday, and we will attempt to build a programme as best we can thereafter, once we also have submissions, the deadline 3 submissions from everybody, that give us a sense of the likely time requirement.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Sorry, that sounds very sensible of way forward.
I think it's as good as we're going to get it. I think if we try and get too certain with diaries right now, with floating accompanied site inspection to deal with, we could end up having to revisit it all, which would be a disaster. Okay, so if I then look at where we find ourselves, can I ask everybody if there is clarity about what we have said we're going to do, with the exception of the hearing dates, which we know are floating around a little bit. Is everybody else clear about everything else? And we know we've got a mechanism to get to the hearing dates because you're going to make deadline 3 submissions about what you want. Yep. In which case, I think that is agenda item 11 resolved. And so, I am going to close this hearing if it is the last thing I do, Mr. Linus.
I say I really do hesitate to resist from Scott Linus, the applicant. We've noticed the next issue-specific hearing, sir, there is an agenda item 3 where it said the examining authority here bodies representing fisheries and fishermen on effects on navigation and operational safety for fishing vessels.
Yes.
And just want to confirm the extent to which, obviously, safety navigation is being considered as a general matter today, but is that still an agenda item?
It is.
Right.
And we were very conscious in providing for it separately, and the reason why we provided for it separately is essentially we were very conscious that we know that we have a large number of fishing and fisheries interested parties. We also know that the fishing community are essentially likely to want something that is more after the style of an open floor hearing in terms of the way that they interact with us. We felt that if we forced members of the fishing community to this hearing in order to interact with navigation safety issues in this hearing, that frankly we would not get the business of today done at all.
Yes,
so we made a very, very conscious decision to enable the fishing community to bring to our attention concerns that they have about navigation safety in their own hearing. Because, frankly, otherwise, if we'd have had 20 other participating interested parties in this hearing, you can imagine it would not have worked. So that's the madness behind the method. having reached that position, what that probably means is that I think it would be wise if you are able to reserve your relevant experts. What we don't, I think, need to do is go into issues of principle, because issues of principle have been dissected before us in two previous hearings. But what we do need to do is give the individual interested parties who have concerns an opportunity to raise those concerns. And if you need to respond to them technically, you may want to call on your experts.
Scotland NFL, that's understood. Thank you, sir.
Okay. In which case, ladies and gentlemen, let us close this hearing. And for some of us, the purgatory of 6:30 awaits. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.